Halloween.
So the Sedra is Chayesara in the Feldheim Chumash, it's page 36, and we begin with trying to answer the paradox of why it is that the Sedra is called Chayesara, the life of Sarah, when it actually deals with her death and burial. So there's an answer given by the Baal HaTurim, one of the great commentaries on the Chumash, who lived around about 700 years ago probably, and maybe slightly more, and he writes a commentary. It's very short, but he reveals lots of interesting connections between different words in different places and so on. So over here he says vayeyu, we take the numerical value of the word vayeyu, and a reminder of what the numerical value of the letters is, that a vav is 6, a yud is 10, that makes 16, a hey is 5, and that makes 21, another yud is 10 makes 31, and the vav at the end makes 37. Actually, it's a word that's a palindrome, because vayiyu is the same backwards as forwards. It's vav, yud, hey, yud, vav, isn't it? But I'm not sure I've seen anything about that. But when we take that numerical value, we then read it as follows. The normal translation is vayiyu chaye sorrow. And the life of sorrow was, or were, it's in the plural actually, Me'ah shana, 100 years, v'hesim shana, 20 years, v'sheva shana, and 7 years, shenei chai sara, the years of the life of sara. But he takes it and says, if you read it slightly differently based on the gematria, the numerical value, you would read it, the life of Sarah was 37. But we know she didn't live 37 years, she lived 127. So what are these 37 years that are being referred to here? So he very simply points out that those were the years of Yitzchak. That he was 37 years old when she passed away. Very simple calculation. She was 90 years old when he was born. She was 127 years old when she died. Subtract 90 from 127, you get 37. So he was 37. So now the Pasuk is telling us that the real life of Sarah was when she was living with her son. And what it's telling us is that the true aim of Jewish life is the next generation. Many, many things in Jewish life are geared at ensuring that the next generation will pick up the teachings of Judaism and perpetuate them, and continue throughout the destiny of the Jewish people with the same enthusiasm as the first generation. And we achieve this through Jewish education. This, by the way, is not just for one's own children. One can educate other people's children as well. The Talmud says that anybody who educates or looks after someone else's child, it's as if they bore that child. They're credited with the birth and upbringing of that child if they only do something to enhance the life of that child. We learn this actually from the daughter of Pharaoh, who was called Bissia, and she brought up Moshe in the palace. So the Talmud says that in the Book of Chronicles, the last book of the Bible, it reckons the children of Bissia. And it gives a number of names, I think there's 10 names there, and it turns out that they're all names that refer to Moses. Moses had 10 names. One of them is Moshe, the others are Avigdor, and so on. So, and Tuvia is another name.
Well, I'd like to know one's name.
So, the Talmud says she never had these children. In fact, she didn't. Maybe she had some later. But this is all referring to Moses. And it's referring to Moses, and she is credited with bearing and raising Moses because she brought him up. So she's credited as his mother. So we see that it isn't exclusive to motherhood. Anyone can do this. And we find that people...
Sarah brought up Moses.
No. this year, the daughter of Pharaoh.
Wasn't Moses brought up by the under Pharaoh's account?
His daughter. Pharaoh's daughter.
Oh, I see. It was Pharaoh's daughter.
So she took him home to the palace.
Right.
So Pharaoh, no doubt, had some involvement there as well. Not that positive, but she brought him up in the palace, and she's credited with being his mother. So this is the key to the explanation over here. The real years of Sarah are those years that she had the opportunity to bring up her son and make sure his education was untainted. Now, where do we see that she put in extra effort to make sure that his education was untainted? Well, there's a story in one of the previous sedras in last week's sedra about how Yishmael, her co-wife's son, because Avram married his maidservant Hagar, and had Yishmael from her. So this Yishmael was actually 13 years older than Yitzhak, so he was in the position of being an influence on this little boy. So as they grew older, he showed himself to be a bad influence, and Rashi explains that he attempted to show Yitzhak evil ways, and at one point he even tried to kill him. And he did it by pretending to shoot him. You know the story of William Tell, and having to shoot the apple from his son's head. So it was a similar thing, that he put something, I don't know exactly what he put, on Yitzhak's head, and he shot at it with an arrow, and he said, "I'm just playing." Of course, he could easily have misjudged the arrow and shot Yitzhak in the head. And he, when people said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm just playing, you know, it's only a game." He pretended that it was nothing, but he had evil intent. And one of the reasons why he had this evil intent was because he was jealous, because he learned that the Yerusha, the inheritance, would go to Yitzhak, not to him. Because he's the son of a maidservant, and the son of a maidservant does not inherit, but the son of the mistress does inherit. So he was jealous of that. But that's where we see that Sarah took strong and decisive action to do something about this, whereby she pleaded with Avram to banish Yishmael from the house, together with his mother. And indeed, they were banished from the house. Later on, in many years later, he came back, he did tshuva, he became a good person, and even his mother was a good person, in essence. And she came back and remarried Abraham when Sarah died. But at that time, Yishmael had evil intentions, and Sarah took decisive action to ensure that there was no negative influence on her son. And even Avram himself did not spot that solution, because he was a man of kindness, and he could not tolerate the idea that he would banish his own son. It's true, he banished him and gave them food and drink for the way and so on, did his best by them, but still, to banish a child and the mother is very drastic action. And he didn't feel he could do it until God told him that he must listen to Sarah, because she was right. And there we learn that sometimes when bringing up children, one has to take a tough line. It's sometimes the softly line is not the solution. And sometimes children have to hear a firm view and a firm guidance, and they want to hear that. And we shouldn't be afraid of being firm with the children and ensuring that they understand what's demanded of them and try and keep to those guidelines. Some parents misguidedly think that if they're very soft on their children, the children will love them more. And the reverse is true, that if one's too soft with the children and doesn't discipline them, of course that discipline has to be done with love and with cleverness. We're not talking about wielding the stick. We're talking about...
We always used to say, "I'm punching thoughts."
Right?
Never did any harm.
He never did any harm.
Do you not know that?
Those days are gone. Those days are long gone. Any parents that hit their children risk being reported to Childline,
to Harry Gay,
Harry Gay Council.
Yeah, but that was different. That's beating up a child, isn't it?
So now the pendulum has swung too far the other way, yes. And parents and teachers and authorities are running away from their obligations of disciplining children. It can be done in a loving way, as long as it's done with firmness, together with love. It does not need to be yelling and shouting and screaming, and it does not need to be with wielding the big stick. But it should be with discipline and firmness. And love. So this is a lesson that Sora taught us in Jewish education. To stand up for what is right, even if it's going to cost someone's happiness. But the welfare of the child and the education of the child is paramount. So we shouldn't be too soft and take into account people's feelings when it's out of place to do so. You end up with...
Because it wasn't even the child here that was getting disciplined, was it? It was around the child. It was what was going on around the child.
Right, Yishmael was already a teenager at that time. Yeah, maybe more.
So how is it that Ishmael, if he was brought up, eventually came back to Abraham's house, how is it he followed this different line?
Well, he started off being a wild person, and God said to his mother that she's going to, when she first was going to become pregnant with him, God informed her that she's going to have a child who's going to be a pero adam, who's going to be a wild person, and yoda bako the yadko, but he's going to have his hands in everything, and so on. And that was a prophecy. Where the rabbis tell us, however, that in later years, towards his old age, he did actually become reformed character.
A reformed, but he didn't follow the Jews, the Hebrew line, did he?
No, he did not convert to be a Jew. No. But he was a good person at the end of his life. Unfortunately, his descendants did not follow his positive views of Jews that he developed in his later years. So we know that he is accepted as having repented because Yishmael is actually a Jewish name. Even though Yishmael was the father of the Arab nation, who are not exactly our friends, and in his early years he was not exactly a righteous person, but we have in the Talmud, we have in the Mishnah, a great rabbi called Rabbi Yishmael. So if Yishmael was not a desirable person, we have a principle of not calling our children after people who are not desirable people, whose behavior was not desirable at least. Because we know that calling the child by a name influences the child. So Jewish parents try their best to call their child after a tzaddik, a righteous person, or an ancestor who hopefully is also a good person, was also a good person. Why? Because we have we are assured that the name that a child is called actually has an influence on the behavior of the child in the future. It doesn't dictate, but it influences. So the fact that in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, there is a great rabbi called Rabbi Yishmael is a proof that Yishmael was an acceptable person at the end of his life. Mm-hmm. So, an interesting bit of background over there. So now we get back to the point of what Sarah stood for was the education of her child. And now we can understand why the Sedra is able to start off by saying these were Vayu Chai Sarah. This was the life of Sarah, because it's referring to the years that she spent with her son Yitzchak. Now what about the actual years that she lived? It was 127. So in English we say 127. In Hebrew we say Meya Ve'esrim v'sheva shanim. Sometimes it's in the reverse. That would be 127. Sometimes it's in reverse. We say sheva v'esrim u'mea. The reverse. So 7 and 20 and 100. Whichever way round it is, we do not add the word year after each number. So in English it would be tantamount to saying, how old are you? I'm 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. Well, why are you saying the word years again? Just say, I'm 127 years. So Rashi asks this question and says, why is it that the text tells us the word year after each of these numbers? And he tells us that it's to tell us that there's a comparison between the age she was at 100 and when she was 20, that just at the age of 20 a person is untainted by sin. Why? Because the rabbis tell us that no one is punished by the heavenly court until they're 20. A person is basically not responsible for their actions in heaven until they're 20. We know that they are responsible for their actions at the age of bar mitzvah, and for a girl, bas mitzvah, at the age of 12, and 13 for a boy. And at that age, the child of 12 or 13 could, in principle, be tried by court and punished for a wrongdoing that they've done. But in the heavenly court, they do not punish until 20. So it's saying that when she was 20, she was therefore untainted by sin, because she was unpunishable. And it's saying that at the age of 100, she was similarly innocent. And it's also telling us something about her beauty, that at the age of 20 she was as beautiful and unspoiled as a child of 7. Of course, we know that a child of 7 has a different kind of beauty than a woman of 20. But what it means is this unspoiled innocence of youth, which is at the age of 7 she had at the age of 20. And then it says, Shnei Chai Sara, the years of the life of Sarah, to tell us, Rashi says, that they were all equal for good. She was at Tzedekes, at Tzidkonis, a righteous woman, whose all her days and all the days of Abraham were filled with content. A little later on in the Sedra, it says that Vavrom Zokim Bo Bayomim Vashem Beirach Es Avrom Bakor. Avrom was old, advanced in days, and God blessed Avram with everything. It echoes something in last week's Sedra, where it says about Sarah as well. Vavram v'sora zekenim bo'im bayomim. That Avram and Sarah were old, advanced in days. So the question is asked, it says it twice, why would it say this expression? It seems to be redundant. Vavram zekenim, Avram v'sora zekenim. They were old and advanced in days. Surely old means advanced in days, doesn't it?
Yes.
It just means you're measuring the time span in days. You could say advanced in years. You could say advanced in months. You can say advanced in days. It's just a bigger number, that's all. If somebody is 90, they've lived for 90 times 365 days. Yes. Which is not much, around about 33,000 days. So, a lot of days. So, Why say it twice? If you're old, you're advancing this. So the rabbis point out, Hasidic teachings point out, that they had utilized all their days. Advanced in days means that they took with them all their days. There was no wasted day. A person can be old and have wasted loads and loads of time. The Rebbe himself used to talk about the old people who were like children. He would say that there's a boy with a white beard. That was the expression he'd use. A yingle bit of Iceberg. He's a young boy with a white beard. What does it mean? It means he's got a white beard. He's 80 years old, but he's not utilized his time to advance in learning, in achievement, in all the things a person's supposed to do. So a person can remain young in achievement.
In spiritual Torah.
Spiritual sense. A yingle mit avayis abod. You can have a boy with a white beard. He's a boy in achievement and Torah. He's not pressed forward to utilize his time to the full. But Avram and Sarah utilized every single moment of every single day. The first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Shneur Zalman, who actually never lived in Lubavitch, not as a Rebbe anyway, he did as a young boy, but he lived in Lyozhin and Liadi, he was wont to say that we have to keep time, we have to value time.
Thank you.
And he said the following in Yiddish, Winter dike nacht und a zume dike tag is a year. That means a winter's night and a summer's day is a year. Of course it's not a year, but it means a winter's night. Look, it starts at 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock. You got till 12 midnight. You could do so much. A person could sit and learn lots of Torah in those hours. And a summer's day ends at 10 o'clock at night. Look what the amount of time you got to spend. A winter's night and a summer's day is a year. It's like it's bringing out this tremendous content and potential that there is in time. And he says, and also quoted there. Stopped a little while back.
Thank you very much.
In the same place, it's quoted that the, I think again it was the Alter Rebbe said that a wasted day is not just a wasted day. It's an inyan b'chaim. It's a whole subject in one's life. It's a whole sort of structure in one's life to waste a day. So this gives us the idea of the content within Sarah's life that she utilized, and Avram also utilized every single moment. And that's why it's, Rashi says, Shnei Chayei Sarah, all of the Meshavim L'Tovah, she was utilizing every moment. Of course, it's extremely difficult to be on the ball all the time and to be conscious of the fact that we shouldn't be wasting our time. So now the question arises, how do we handle this? Does that mean to say I can never relax? What about sleeping? Am I wasting my time when I'm sleeping? Am I wasting my time when I'm eating? Am I wasting my time when I'm relaxing? So the Rebbe answered this question by quoting from Maimonides in Hilchos Deos, where Maimonides says that we have a principle, b'chol d'rochecho do'ehu. In all your ways, you should know God. Now that's a quote, I think it's in Keheles, I think, I'm not sure. And it says, b'chol d'rochecho do'ehu, in all your ways, you should know God. So what that is saying, what do you mean, all your ways? It can't be referring to prayer. Because obviously when a person's praying, of course they know God, they're talking to God. It can't be talking about when we're learning Torah, because we're learning God's Torah at the time. And it doesn't say b'chol drachov do'ehu, in all his ways you should know him. It says b'chol drachecho do'ehu, in all your ways you should know him. So what ways is it talking about? It's talking about the things which are not holy in themselves, such as eating and drinking and sleeping and relaxing. And it's saying that those times also should be knowing God. Now what does that mean? I'll give you an example of a sportsman. Sportsman, an astronaut. What kind of regime, let's say someone is going in for the Olympics. The Olympic sportsman, an athlete, a runner. In the months before the Olympics, he's training. A footballer, you know, top-ranking footballer before the World Cup. You know, they're training every single day. But you know something, not just the training. The trainer says to them, you know, I don't want you to go boozing. Yeah. You're not to go boozing at night. Because that'll ruin your ability to, you know, you'll lose your proof, you'll lose your breath, your strength. There's no going boozing. You've got to go to bed early. You've got to eat properly. Mm. In other words, this athlete or this footballer or the astronauts, their lives are like regimented. They're on the, you know, on the site of where the training takes place. They don't go home. They're on site. And they're training for all the things they're going to need to be able to do when they're on the rocket. So their eating is monitored, and their drinking is monitored, and their sleeping is monitored, and their weight is monitored, and their relaxation is monitored. So what is this telling us? This is telling us that the athlete or the astronaut are doing all the things that a normal person does, but they're keeping in mind the ultimate aim.
Yeah.
They've got in mind, I've got to be careful how I sleep, and how I eat, and how I relax, because I don't want to affect the ultimate aim of what I'm trying to achieve.
The goal.
Absolutely right.
I came there to do.
So the same thing with a Jew. At all times, we're allowed to live as a normal human being. We've got to eat and sleep and drink and relax and even go on holiday and do the things a person normally does. But we have to have in the back of our mind, why am I doing this? Is it to enjoy myself? Is it solely to enjoy myself? I'm going off and bombing around India just for the fun of it? Or am I bearing in mind that this is going to help me in my service of God? And that is the essential difference.
I don't think the regular Israelis that go around India are looking for God. But they probably...
I use them as an example of those that are not. I agree with you.
So they are looking for God. That's why they go to somewhere like India.
No.
But they could find God on the way.
They could. But I use that as an example of somebody who's going to relax for his own purposes, but not for any higher purpose. So the idea is that we have to always bear in mind that we have a higher purpose.
This is a strict regime. This is their goal. They're there to do a job, and this is the machine. This is the routine they have to do to achieve that goal.
So we, as Jews, are also living under a regime, under God's regime. And we should bear in mind that we should always be aiming to enhance our service of God. So that means that we've actually gained a tremendous amount. Because if a person says, I'm going to have a shlof, because I want to go for a shlof, so those 8 hours that they went for a shlof is wasted time.
How can you not say that? You've got to have a shlof.
Sometimes people are...
I'm saying it depends why.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes.
So a person should have in their mind, you know, I'm going to bed, I need to be fresh for tomorrow, I've got to get to shul early tomorrow. I'm not just going to bed just for the sake of going to bed. I'm going to bed because I know I need to go to bed, but I've got to be up for shul tomorrow morning. So that means that the 8 hours that you're sleeping is part of going to shul. You've actually gained 8 hours of activity in serving God.
It's like it's like myself. If I have to go to bed a certain time, I've got to be up. I've got to be on my feet for 8 hours a day.
Right.
Things happen. You go out there. But I mean, I strip myself out. That's certain time.
So you've illustrated it.
That's it.
That your aim in getting up in the morning is getting to your job, and
that's right,
because you know you're going to be on your feet. So I'm just saying, just give it a little twist. And say, I'm going to get my sleep in order that I should be able to serve God properly. And you know what? Going to work is also serving God.
What if you can't sleep because you've got a mice infestation?
Have you tried getting a cat?
Don't like cats.
It's one way of getting rid of
it. I don't like them.
No.
But thank you.
Okay.
So how does one sleep?
We'll discuss it at the end of the show.
You don't
like sleeping.
I love sleeping. I can't.
You can't.
Oh,
that's
Dr.
Lowenthal's here.
Not very...
Dr. Lowenthal's
here.
Okay.
That's
Dr. Robinson, I presume.
I love sleeping.
Dr. Robinson,
I presume.
Okay, we'll leave it there.
Okay.
We had a lesson in B'chol.
We've actually done a bit of...
Thank you.